Hello, everyone. Welcome back to I See What You're Saying, the Disciplined Listening Podcast. I'm Michael Reddington, and today it is my pleasure to welcome our next guest, Mark Anderson. Mark is the Director of Training and Development at Anderson Investigative Associates. Prior to starting his own organization, he was a special agent for the United States Department of Justice Office of the Inspector General. He was also an instructor within the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center Behavioral Science Division, and he was even a special agent at the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission. With those great credentials, I'm really excited to dive into this conversation with Mark as we explore not only his experience, but his philosophy into how we can connect with people to get more truth in all of our high-value conversations. So we're going to get into lots of topics like how can we ask questions designed to maximize the information we obtain? He's got a great quote about the intensity of our involvement. He also talks about how we should be listening to advance our conversation and why it's important to ask better questions, not more questions. He has so much value to share, so many techniques we can all apply. I'm really excited to get into the conversation. Again, thank you all for being here for another week and another conversation. We really appreciate it. Before we dive in, let's thank our sponsors. First, we have Humantel. If you've ever wanted to develop the skill set to know what people are likely thinking and feeling at any moment in time, by accurately interpreting shifts in their facial expressions and nonverbal communication, then please head over to humantel.com. Read their research, check out their articles, choose which training program is best for you, select yours, and get started. I've taken all of the training myself. I highly recommend it. It's best in class. It's self-paced. And if you enter the code INQUASIVE25, you'll get 25% off the training program of your choice. That's all over at humantel.com. For the professional interviewers, please check out certifiedinterviewer.com. That's where you'll get all your questions answered about the International Association of Interviewers. What does it take to join at the personal and organizational level? What tools and opportunities are available from online training to in-person training events to tools and resources, networking opportunities, chances to contribute to the organization, and so much more. CertifiedInterviewer.com is also where you will get all your questions answered about the Certified Forensic Interviewer designation. What it takes to qualify, how we need to prepare to pass the exam, what it takes to maintain the designation, what it can mean for your career, and so much more over at certifiedinterviewer.com. And while you're online, please check out inquasive.com. That's where you can learn more about the programs our clients ask us to custom facilitate for their senior leaders, business development teams, negotiators, human resource executives, and more to teach them the skills, perspectives, and techniques necessary to obtain the everyday confessions in all of their high-value business and personal conversations. All that and more at inquasive.com. Thank you all again for being here week after week. We truly appreciate it. And now, without further ado, I introduce to you Mark Anderson. Hello, Mark. It is so great to see you. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you for having me on, Michael. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. We've been in touch for a while now. I think this is one of the first times we've actually had the opportunity to have a conversation. We spoke together at an event recently. It was awesome to see your presentation. And now I'm really excited to dive in and share your experience and your expertise with everybody else.
I'm looking forward to talk to you. I appreciated your presentation as well. I appreciate the show and everything you're doing out in the space that you're working in. It's awesome.
Well, thank you, man. I really appreciate it. So let's dive in. You've been a practitioner. You've been an instructor. You are an instructor. You had the opportunity to interview people who had been trained in interviewing and had been a part of investigations and audits and knew where you were going. So you, over the years, we won't tell anyone how many years, have been fine-tuning your skill set in many, many ways. I felt like I could make that joke because you made it earlier when we were talking. So here's the first question I would love to dive into. because you have been doing this for so long, and I mean that as a compliment, I have to imagine that a lot of the investigative interviewing philosophies, approaches, techniques at this point have really permeated your daily life, either in your business or when you're out as a consumer in the world, whatever it is. So from your perspective, what are some of the most powerful investigative techniques that you use every day in your business and personal life?
That's an excellent question. I'll respond to the age thing first. When I teach and I do my biography, I said it's rather long at this point. I said there's only two things to get out of that. Number one, I'm old, and number two, I can't hold down a job. So that's what you get from my bio. But that's a great question. And I actually talk about that a lot when I'm doing training, is that we need to be, and I know these words are very important to you as well. We need to have integrity and credibility in what we do. We should all have that. No matter what we're doing, we have to have that. They say the only thing we take to the ground with us when we go is our integrity. So I plan to keep that. I probably won't have much else. So as part of that, on the outside, what I've found as useful as on the inside is to be consistent and have that integrity in who I am, because we can do the same things we do in investigative interviewing in general conversation and have a very positive impact. It's not like we have two languages for that. I go back to something my dad used to say when I was growing up, Mark, it's not what you say, it's how you say it. We can be very empathetic and very communicative in the way we say things, even though they're kind of fashioned and toned for an investigative interviewing. So what am I talking about there? How do we ask questions? Are we asking effective questions to maximize information, or are we asking polite speak, leading questions, things like that, that are not going to get us quality information or is going to result in us having to ask more questions? So I want to ask questions that are going to maximize information. If you go to a restaurant and you say, is the meatloaf good? There's very few restaurants where they're going to say, no, it really sucks. They're going to say, yeah, it's good. So why are we asking that question? It's a useless question. What do I ask instead? Hey, if you were eating here tonight, what would you have? You know, what's the number one selling thing on the menu tonight? And why is that? So we can fashion questions. So if you think about that question, you think about in a business relationship, you think about in a sales relationship, you think about at the medical doctor, why are we asking questions that are not going to maximize that which we get? So that would be one. But coupled with that, what you and I were just talking about is, are we listening to the answer? Do we have a plan for why we're there? Have we strategized why we're there? Are we listening to hear that answer in order to advance that conversation? And number two is having some compassion and empathy on the person we're talking to, depending on the situation, so that we're maximizing that ability to have interaction. So, I mean, that's three, and that's just off the top of my head. Essentially, what I want to do is I want to have the same intensity and involvement in those conversations outside the interview room as I want to have in those conversations inside the interview room. And frankly, they should be easier on the outside, because a lot of times the people we're interacting with, we care more about, we have more of a relationship with. So we owe it to them and owe it to ourselves to invest in that situation. So rather long answer to your rather short question. I apologize.
That's how I talk. People ask me a question sometimes when I'm teaching. I'll be like, so 25 minutes later, did I manage to answer your question? So that was short by my standards, but a great answer on so many levels. And I love what you said, the phrase intensity of involvement. That doesn't necessarily mean like I'm intense, like I'm staring you down and I'm using this tone of voice, but this intensity of involvement that the relationship matters, the outcome matters, what I learn in this conversation matters, maybe what I teach in this conversation matters. So I have the intensity of involvement, my energy, my resources, my faculty, I'm engaged in this conversation. People can use phrases like being present and being where your feet are and actively listening. And yeah, okay, fine. But I love that. I'm honestly probably going to steal that phrase, and I'll give you credit for as long as I can remember where I got it from. And then someday I'll just be convinced it was mine. But I love that phrase, intensity of involvement. It's a great way to say it.
I used to work with the guys from Dallas Police Department, the homicide unit a bit. And their take on that was, if you're in the room, I'll give you credit for it. If you're not there, it's mine. So if I'm ever in the room, you have to give me credit. Otherwise, take it, steal it. That's true with all my stuff. You're more than welcome to steal it. Intensity involvement, the reason I use that, because we are so distracted. I'm holding up my phone for those that are not listening to here or listening and not seeing. We're so distracted by all the inputs we have. And I'm so convinced that that's true. The older I get, the more easily I am distracted. I think I started taking that Ashwagandha or whatever it is, it's supposed to help with mental acuity because staying focused, something comes in on LinkedIn and I switch over to look at it. I mean, nothing's that important, you know, and we get so distracted that we have a hard time staying involved in that conversation. So being present doesn't mean the same thing to me as having that intensity of involvement. I would need to invest in you. When I got on with you this morning, I asked some questions about what's going on in your life. Not because I'm being polite, because I actually care. I want to know. I'm not very polite. I mean, anybody that knows me knows that's the case.
You were manipulating me.
No, I wanted to know because I care. I've seen transition in your life, and I know transition can breed adversity, I just want to make sure you're all right. I mean, those things are tough. So we need to care enough. And if we care enough, that intensity of involvement kind of comes naturally associated with that.
You just nailed it as I write notes and talk at the same time. Based on what I do, it's probably not a surprise that one of the questions I get asked often is either what makes a good listener or how do I become a better listener? And we can talk about having an outcome. We can talk about being patient. We can talk about removing distractions. We can talk about asking questions that are more likely not just to maximize information, but help people save face as they're maximizing the information for you. But to me, after we go through all that, it comes down to you need to find a reason to care. Because we can go through all of these tricks and tips and processes and techniques. We can spend days doing all this. But the bottom line is, if you don't care enough about some combination of the person you're talking to or the outcome you can achieve based on this conversation, then you're not going to listen. And that's just it. So you're 1,000% right. We have to care. And you can care for any number of reasons. Like, you know, and maybe this will be the next place we take the conversation. Sometimes people might think that it's easier to care if you're talking to a victim or a witness than it is if you're talking to a suspect. And maybe in a white collar situation, not as much, but in a crime against a person. Now you have a person who's victimized by another. It's easier to care when you're talking to the victim. And intuitively that makes sense, but it's that same care about the victim that should make us care even more when we're talking to the suspect, because now I'm not sitting here in judgment. I'm not sitting here to make you feel like you're a terrible human being and you just threw your life away because of this decision you just made. My job is an independent fact gatherer. And if I do a great job gathering the facts in enough detail, then somebody else can punish this subject even more based on me doing my job. So now I can take the care that I actually have for the victim, use that care to present as empathy when I'm having, like, to rationalize empathizing with somebody whose actions I might detest in order to make the connection necessary to gather the facts necessary for the outcome that we're looking for. I might have just said necessary too many times in one sentence. But I'd be interested in your thoughts on that, because we can take that care and we can use it or present it in different ways to connect with people that we might viscerally disagree with, depending on the situation.
You all just unpacked like a big bag there. That was like a international trip bag on that one.
I can ramble more. See you in rage.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm thinking about a lot of stuff you said there. I think that number one, we'll go back to the initial one of the initial things you said. Remember what our role is here. I am not the decision maker in this situation. I am a fact finder. So if you want to start putting judgment in the interview room, you ought to spend a little time looking in the mirror. And maybe the older I get, the more I realize this. I just used the term this week and somebody thought it was funny. The more tire tracks that have run over me, it's easier for me not to be judgmental of those that I come in contact with. And for me, I just have to look in the mirror and recognize that I've made some bad decisions over time that other people could judge me for. Those people don't necessarily have the right to judge me. We don't have the right to judge in the interview room. That's not what we're there for. And then we could get into a whole discussion about biases and all the rest. We all got biases. The question is, can we keep our biases in the closet while we're doing interviews? You know, recognize your biases, get them out of the interview room, and deal with people for who they are. So the issue of compassion, yeah, I can have a ton of compassion for victims, but I've also talked to victims before that were lying through their teeth. So, you know, why should I have more compassion in that situation? I need to approach every one of these interviews with the intention of understanding where this person is at and who this person is. I don't need to enter those interviews with the intention of judging them for the actions they've taken. And frankly, there's a few places where I've had difficulty keeping that out of, and I'll give one example. When I was working for the FBI, I had a case down in Virginia where I was looking at a guy that was being sexually inappropriate with young boys. And in Virginia, I had three young boys at the time, my sons. And I had a really hard time separating my world from that world. And I remember my boss took the case away from me. I called him and said, "Hey, not for nothing, but why'd you take that case away? I was, you know, making progress on it." And he said, "Well, we thought we would prosecute him, not kill him." And I thought, well, that's probably fair. So I've had problems over time separating out in that arena. And that's why I have great respect that people that investigate in that arena, people that are looking at child pornography and sexual exploitation of children and all the rest. And as I get older, now I have an issue with them doing the same to senior citizens as well. But the issue, I just couldn't separate myself out of that. But on the same hand, I worked international terrorism for a while, and I would sit with those people, and I had agita, heartache over things that they might have done, but I didn't have issues with them as I got to know them. I realized that they had the same struggles I had. They had the same struggles anybody else does, but they were in a different environment than me. And as you realize these things, it becomes easier not to judge them. And really what I need to do is what? Understand them. They don't come from the same world I come from. Maybe understand something outside your own puny little world that is very limited, and it'll become very beneficial to you. So those situations, I want to try to eliminate that wherever I can eliminate that and just understand who they are. Frankly, to me, and you may feel the same, that's the most fascinating part of sitting down with somebody in the interview room. It's not going over the evidence. It's understanding how did this person get to this place at this point in their lives and make this bad choice. And usually it's for very practical reasons that I wouldn't make the choice, but that doesn't mean I can judge them for making it. And all I have to do is really look in the mirror and think about some of those choices I've made over time. And maybe I need to shut up and listen a little bit. So there's a long answer to your long question. I equaled up on that.
Nice. We're going to go an hour on like three questions. That's how this whole conversation is going to play out. And again, you hit on so many important points there. And I do think, you know, reflecting for myself, you know, but for the grace of God, right? You know, how many times did I go left mm-hmm. when I should have gone right? In another one step in that direction, my life changes. Or how many times did I go right when if I went left, then my life ends up in a completely different place? And just this, we were talking before we came on, I just got back from the elite training days for the International Association of Interviewers. And we had a former police chief and a current detective. The police chief was from Aurora, Illinois. The detective was from Chicago, Illinois, talking about a active shooter case that they ran point for, and then a homicide investigation that they ran, the two separately. And they both hit on exactly what you just said. Like, how do you begin to understand what happened to put somebody in this situation? I'm a firm believer that you probably more so than me, considering the cases you were involved with and a lot of the cases I was involved with. But for me, I'm willing to bet strong money that 90 to 95% of the people I interviewed would have made a different decision if they were in a different situation.
Absolutely.
And that doesn't absolve them of responsibility. It doesn't resolve them of accountability. I'm not saying they shouldn't be punished. I'm not saying any of that.
Right.
But just if you look at, and this is what I heard you say, embrace the universality of the human experience, that you could sit down and talk to somebody involved with international terrorism and find common bonds as human beings, because no matter where you're from in the world, you're going to have the same emotions, the same fears, the same desires, the same requirements for a satisfactory human experience. But those things are going to hit or miss differently depending on where you are in the world. And depending on where you are in the world, if you're not getting what you need from your family, from your friends, from your community, you can move to another city, or you can join a sports team, or you can join a therapy club, or you can do whatever you need. Therapy clubs, I don't know if they exist, but you know where I'm going. Or if you're in the other side of the world, maybe you get recruited by an extremist organization, and now you're getting, okay, they're using you, but you're getting, in your perception, what you weren't getting from somewhere else. So much quality there for withholding judgment, understanding where other people come from. Just yesterday, no, I'm going too long. I got an email from somebody with one of my clients saying that they felt disrespected because their name was spelled wrong in an email.
Get over it.
I'm not here to say whether you were intentionally disrespected or not. There's a lot of things that I don't know. So my response was thanking them for sharing it with me, promising them that it would be addressed as part of what we're doing, because I will. That's easy enough. But then also at the end saying, let's consider the context. I'm not here to say whether it was disrespectful or not. And that could be a valid response based on history that I'm not aware of. But was the name misspelled because somebody was in a rush? Was the name misspelled because they were distracted? Was the name misspelled because they're not a detailed oriented person? And the name is spelled a little bit uniquely, and they went with a common spelling instead. So I'm not saying that it's not okay to initially feel disrespected, but let's withhold that terribly judgmental response before considering the totality of circumstances and alternatives, which in a lot of ways is what you're talking about. And it comes from that investigative mindset. So I'll close that ramble by asking you this. What do you believe it means to have an investigative, or to maintain an investigative mindset?
Well, I seem to think I have one going all the time, because I get in discussions with people and I ask those questions that dig a little bit deeper in people's lives. And I think a lot of times I do that because of the example you just gave. Who knows if that person that spelled that name is not going through an extremely traumatic situation in their own personal life that you know nothing of. And then does it really matter how they spelt your damn name? You know what I mean? If somebody's in the middle of that pain, I want to find out if that pain is there. So I'm going to ask those questions. So that investigative mindset is just I think there's a combination of curiosity and empathy that factors into the way I address and try to understand people, because I care. So having an investigative mindset, I think it's more about a human dynamic of actually investing in the people around you than it is anything else.
I love it. And I especially that combination, I just wrote it down, of curiosity and empathy. So the curiosity drives the genuine interest in gathering information and then figuring out where to apply it as you go. And the empathy drives the genuine interest in the person that you're having a conversation with, to connect with them at a level that, it might sound cheesy, but inspires them to continue the conversation.
Yeah, and that frankly isn't that hard to do in today's times, because people don't do that. So it's very easy to pull people into that. I think you're going to have to say stuff along the way like, hey, I'm sorry if this seems too invasive, but I'm really concerned about this. We're going to have to use phrases to help them to understand that you're not just being odd by asking these questions or creepy or something. But again, having that empathy, you're going to be able to say those things to put that person at ease so they can open up. There's so many people with a story that can't say the story because nobody cares around them cares enough to ask.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of people that are suffering from significant pain points because of that. And I think that's where we become very successful in the interview room. When you have an interviewee who's interacted with investigators or law enforcement previously, and they say, "Dude, I've never been talked to like this before." Man, that's the greatest compliment on the face of the earth. And all you say is, "I'm sorry that that hasn't happened previously. Tell me more." Because we're investing at a level where, and you say, "Well, yeah, but are you manipulating them because you want something?" Yeah, I want something, but that's not why I'm manipulating them. I am talking to them because I want to understand where they're at. And the only way we're going to accomplish the mission we've been given, which is to get that the greatest amount of truth possible, is by investing in that person, not by beating them over the head with a stick.
Amen. I couldn't agree anymore. I want to jump back before I forget to the word manipulation. I at least twice, if not more, in the last 3 weeks at sessions that I've been facilitating, I've had people say, "Well, this feels manipulative. I don't want to manipulate people." And I'd really appreciate your thoughts on this. To me, the term manipulation is a neutral term. It's not positive or negative. And by the way, we all manipulate people all day long. Do you think my son, who's an amazing kid, is going to get out of bed, make his bed, shut his lights off, get dressed, have breakfast, brush his teeth, pack his lunch, and do everything to get out of the house on time if I don't manipulate him? And there's nobody that loves another person on this planet more than I love my wife and son. But here I am manipulating my son to get him out of the house. We manipulate people all the time. I want the person at the grocery store to move a little faster, so I smile and nod and offer to help bag. Now, I'm going to bag because I offered, but I'm manipulating them. So to me, I feel like that term manipulation is neutral, and it is our intentions and the techniques that we use that you could argue, I guess, the outcomes we're looking to achieve as well. So it's our intentions slash outcomes and the techniques we use that make it, for lack of better phrases, either ethical or unethical. I'm curious as to your thoughts on that.
That's really good. I'll be thinking about that for the rest of the day. So we'll go with an answer now, and then I'll spend some more time thinking about it, because I like that. And I used to laugh. My wife used to say to me, "You're being manipulative." And I'd say, "No, I'm being persuasive." And I think that really becomes the issue. The issue becomes we get focused on a word. And that word becomes a dirty word for some reason, and we don't want to use that word anymore. And I think that I think that's the problem, because I think that if you said the sentence that you said in describing that to me, and I'm not going to be able to quote you because I can't remember that long, where you said, "What I'm trying to do is to move this person," you know, however you said it, when we say that long sentence, that would be more palatable to some people than using the term manipulation. And I think that's what we end up having to be more wordy, not to offend somebody, because everybody wants to be offended by somebody. And you talk about your son, you're manipulating your son to get him to do what you want him to do. But in fact, he's manipulating you by trying not to do those things. You know, it is a point of, it's just part of the human condition. Yeah. If you think it doesn't exist, you're nuts, you know? So I don't think manipulation is a dirty word at all. I understand how people get caught up in that. I think you're absolutely right. Is what is your motivation for doing it? If your motivation is to get that person to tell you something that isn't true just because that's what you want, that's an unethical motivation. That's a corrupt motivation. It's not pure of heart. And that is that negative manipulation. If I'm trying to move someone, and maybe that's what we say, is I'm trying to move someone from this unwilling state to this willing state, I'm going to have to do some things to make that happen. That could be called manipulation. Maybe I call it empirical love to accomplish an objective. Would that be more palatable to you? You know what I'm saying?
I just felt warm. Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't see it as a negative thing necessarily. I see it much more objectively. But again, where's your mindset? And have you been watching TV and so manipulation is bad? Or are you trying to accomplish, I take it back to mission all the time. What's your mission? Am I using tools to accomplish that mission that are ethical in nature that will move me to that place?
Yeah, I agree. It's one of the areas that we overlap for sure. You can use manipulation, you can use persuasion, you can use motivation, but I was just about to use a phrase I hate, but I started to, so I'm going to do it anyway, and people can make fun of me. At the end of the day, more often than not, when we talk to people, they're more motivated to say or do something different than we want them to do. And if, as long as what we want them to do isn't unethical, won't injure them, isn't for our benefit and their detriment, you can go down that list of things, then we're going to manipulate each other all day long. Nobody manipulates me more than my wife and son, just based on our proximity, the amount of things we do together, the amount of time in a day we have to do those things. So, yeah, you're
100%. Based on relationship.
Yes.
Based on relationship. I mean, you're much more easily manipulated by both of them because of your love for them. So if they're trying to, and you don't necessarily say it's manipulation, because of your love, you're willing to do certain things for them. So you wouldn't call it manipulation. What do we call it? Motivation? I don't know. But so think what that deep down the heartfelt feeling is, and understand that that has a negative effect, or that has a positive or negative effect on the word that's being used, i.e. manipulation.
Yeah. So while we're going down the path of either misinterpreted or misrepresented thoughts, ideas, concepts, I know one of the things that you and I, one of the ideas that you and I share in common is the fact that, especially when we talk about interviewing in the communicative side of the investigations world, there are some assumptions, some maybe old fashioned techniques, if that's an okay way to say it, maybe some stereotypical approaches that the scientific community, and thankfully more and more practitioners, are continuing to show that they are either untrue or unethical or coercive. And, we could go down the line. So as you are out there teaching investigators on a regular basis, what are some of these myths or older techniques, if that's a fair way to say it without offending anybody, that you are coaching people to evolve beyond?
Yeah, and that's sure a fair way to say it, and it's true. I mean, when I went through my initial basic training, which would have been probably while you were in diapers, Michael, 1982, what I was taught to do is nowhere near where I am now. It was bad then. It didn't result in good results. So most of my training came from screwing up in the field and figuring out how to do it in a way that would be more practical, which isn't the best way to learn. Certainly when people's lives are at jeopardy and investigations and all the rest, I don't think we want to learn that way. But there's a bunch of them from back then that are still here now. And if you think about it, that's what, 45 years. Where supposedly we knew that wasn't the best way to do it, but it's still being taught. There's still people out there teaching it, which is really irritating. I mean, I understand we don't necessarily want to do new things. The older I get, I kind of like the routine, so I don't like to do new things either. But if there's a reason to do them, we need to do them. I don't believe in doing something new just because it's new. I mean, we've certainly gone through those trends as well. Oh, this is new. Let's try it. No, we don't try it unless it's proven to have some efficacy to improve what we're going to do. And so most of the stuff I'm talking about is in that realm. I think there's a ton of them that are still being practiced, which is one thing. That's my responsibility when I'm in the field to move people away from that because it's not the best way to do it. But the fact that it's still being taught is really irritating to me, because then you get into the whole ethical thing of, why are you teaching it? Are you teaching it because you're making money off of it and you're not considering the impact of that? And I have a huge problem with that. That's why, I mean, if somebody calls me up and said, I need to know something about this, I'll give it to them. I'm probably not a good businessman, but I believe in helping people in this field that we're in to be more ethical and to be more effective in doing what they're doing. It's a hard field. It's a hard business. So what are some of them I'm talking about? Well, we talked about asking questions. There's still a lot of people asking questions in a very bad way that are not going to maximize the information that you get. Questions that were, the best interview isn't the interview with the most questions, it's the interview with the best questions. The more questions we ask, the more chance we're going to make a mistake, and we're going to be running down a rabbit hole with those mistakes. So we got to ask questions well. Number two, what are we doing? How are we observing the person sitting across from us? Are we still looking to see if their eyes go up and to the left? Are we looking to see if they're twitching or their body's moving? Are we focusing on these nonverbal cues that have absolutely nothing to do with deception? And there's tons of people that are doing it, and there's tons of people that are still teaching it. And we really have to get up to date on this stuff. Frankly, I've had some time in the recent couple months where I've really been focusing this, and I am going through hundreds of presentations that I have and retooling them to make sure that I don't have anything in there that dates to the past, because I was taught that stuff in the past. And so I think that we have a responsibility to be ethical enough and to be focused enough to recognize what's going on in the area of research. And I don't care what research says, unless it's consistent with what we're seeing in practice. I'm going to make that jump. And if that jump occurs, then I'm going to look and say, do I need to retool this? So, I mean, there's tons of them. The how we present evidence, you know, how we listen in the interview. Are we practicing with any sort of empathy? Are we still using confrontational techniques of trying to like beat the person over the head with the stick to see if we get the information? Because frankly, those things can get you no information, or they can get you bad information. And either event, that is not what, again, back to the word mission, that's not what our mission is. And we shouldn't be using things that are going to get that negative information. So sorry for the sermon. I went beyond the normal attention span on that, but I hope I answered your question.
You did, and I'm on board with the list. I agree with all of the examples that you just gave, and particularly for me, and I know it's true for other people as well. When I'm out there and people immediately start asking questions about eye movements or crossed arms or some of these stereotypes, it's like that's day one stuff that we should be past. We should be focusing on getting the truth and using either the evidence we have or the evidence we can get, our due diligence in order to help us get there. But when we think about it, and to show some empathy, not necessarily to defend, but to show some empathy, there are any number of agencies, departments, organizations around our country and certainly beyond that either don't have the budget or haven't allocated the budget or haven't prioritized the budget to provide adequate training to their investigators. So what happens is you've got somebody that's been on the job for 20, 30 years, and they're still doing what they were taught 20, 30 years ago because it is getting them some level of success what they can justify as acceptable. Now, along the way, they've no doubt added their personality, their favorite words, their little tricks that they think help them, and then they teach it to the next person. And the next person, because they're new, looks up to the vet and says, well, they've been doing it for a long time. They're clearly successful. They're taking me under their wing. I'm going to do this too. And now I'm going to add my personality, my words, my tricks, the things that I want to do. And I'm going to be successful to a degree that I feel good about that. So that sort of, I don't know what the right phrase to use, but that like institutionalized, this kind of work for me, it'll work for you too, as opposed to the science-based, the methodology-based, the build tools in the toolbox. So I can actually say, well, this is the goal I want to achieve. This is the person I have to achieve it with. This is the context of that situation. Which technique do I think will be best in order to give me the opportunity to do that? So some of us just show empathy. There are plenty of investigators, public sector, private sector, that have been in a situation like that. So they're not necessarily trying to ignore the scientific aspect of it. They just haven't been exposed to it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Totally agree. And frankly, this becomes a switching out of the investigative realm and looking in the leadership realm. This becomes a leadership issue as well of individuals. And I can't speak so much to the private sector as I can to the government side, and especially the federal government side, of managers that think, well, if you got hired for this job, you can interview because you can talk to people, and thinking that's all it takes. And so, limited training funds, but choosing to spend those training funds on things that to me would be questionable if you have a prioritization in an investigative entity. Where should I be spending my funds? I want my people to be able to talk to people first, and then we'll worry about some of the, you know, the fancier programs that they want to. So I question the priority of where they're spending the money from a leadership standpoint, because there's this mindset of, oh, anybody can talk to anybody. It's not that big of a deal, which is just ignorant. It's just ignorant. So then you wonder why the thing happens where you have the propagation of not necessarily good techniques, but that's all they know. It becomes easy to understand how that happens when there isn't this mindset on the fact that things have changed and we need to educate you to those changes in order to become more effective at what we do.
For sure. And as part of that, to circle back to something that you said earlier, some of these techniques or assumptions could shut people down so you don't get anything. It could also get bad information.
And yes,
bad information could come in a couple of different, I guess, categories. It could be, I'm just making shit up so you'll leave me alone. Like, I'm not necessarily lying to you, but I just don't know. And you're not going to believe that I don't know. So I'm just going to give you random stuff so you will leave me alone. It could also come in like a false confession where now I'm confessing to something that I didn't do, didn't have any a part of. And now I am setting myself up for severe consequences, because I feel like it is the only way out of this conversation for me. So with the depth of your experience, what are some of the things you've seen people do, or well, maybe not seen people do, but you know of that investigators can do that are more likely to cause somebody to give us bad information than it is to give them correct information or valuable information?
It's not doing the stuff that we've talked about up to this point. It's having that totally a vacuum in the room. It's using those techniques of continually assaulting that person with words. You know, the way that we approach that individual. It's making statements to them fall into the realm of promises, saying things to them to entice them to say things with that concept of how do I get out of this room? I mean, they're not there thinking, oh, this is great. I couldn't wait to be here today with you. Now, if we're doing some of the stuff that we talked about up front with the empathy and all the rest, that person isn't trying to get out of the room as quickly because they're seeing some benefit to stay there. So number one, if all that stuff is vacuous and it's not there, then that intensity makes that person want to get out of the room. So what will they say to the point of getting out of that room? And you start making them promises. You entice them to say things. Number one, provide them information, leading information, where you're giving them information that they then just feed back to you. And you're not smart enough to realize you're just being fed back that what you're given, or that's accomplishing your objective. So you don't care anyhow. So there's just so many things we can do in that room from a negative standpoint to get that information that's, you know, not good. False confessions, number one, that would be the greatest insult in the world to me as an investigator if I get a false confession. That is not my reason for being there, because remember, what we're there for is to get the truth. If I've gotten a false confession, I didn't get the truth. I failed. So I don't want that happening. I would rather have nothing at all than have a false confession. But I think the bigger issue isn't that so much that is the spurious, useless, untrue information that's also unpacked because of the way you led this person, that then you spend investigative resources trying to resolve. So, I mean, there's just so many. Or you find out about this one event and you don't find out about these three events because of the way you ask the questions. I mean, there's just so many things we can do wrong by using those old, outdated techniques and not employing the empathy and all the rest.
Yeah, I had a follow-up question all lined up until you said that last piece, and I got to try to remember them both. But that piece you just said about you might get the truth about one thing, but not the other three, is so true and so important. And we used to say you don't get cool points for fast confessions, you get cool points for full confessions. So
right.
How am I engaging with somebody in a way that helps them save face and feel like it is okay, it lines up with their self-image, not just to give me some information, but to continue to give it to me over time? And then how do I continue to recognize these red flags and opportunities that there's more threads to pull? So that was, there are so many times investigators go in not realizing that this could be a pattern crime, that this most likely isn't the first time they did it, because who really ever gets caught the first time they do something they shouldn't have? Only the worst criminals ever. Or the unluckiest.
We're not that good.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're not that good.
No.
So I think that's a huge issue, Michael. I think that's a huge issue because, and again, reference mostly my federal career, we were great at taking out low-hanging fruit. You know, great at doing that. Not so great at taking out the higher level situations. But the number of times I looked at a case and I thought when that complaint came in, this isn't the first time they've done this. Or this is just a little bit a pimple on the side of what this really is going on here. And the number of times I was told, well, just stick to what the complaint is. Well, what do you mean stick to what the complaint is? What is our mission here? Our mission is to address fraud, waste, and abuse, you know, and this is just a portion of it. Yeah, but that's going to get more complex. Blah, blah, blah. Hey, it is what it is. So, you know, the number of times I was told that, and so then the only way I was going to get to expand that scope was what? Do an interview where I got the person to tell me the scope, and then you can go back and the prosecutor or decision makers say, well, you need to investigate the rest of this. You know, even though the agency isn't supporting it, right? So it became imperative to get that. How do you get that? You're not going to get that by beating people over the head. You're going to have to develop enough trust in that room. And if you talk about a place where the issue of manipulation, back to that word, or, you know, moving that person to not only be able to tell you about A, but to tell you about B, C, and D as well, is only going to happen through a process of moving them to that, which could be considered manipulation. But it's number one, freeing them of the burden that they have, resolving this issue completely in that room, accomplishing the mission that you've been given. There's just every reason in the world to do it. So, I mean, I don't know. That's just a huge issue to me. We don't do good at looking at the other things this person probably is involved in or that they know about that caused them to say, oh, I can do this too. I'm doing this because those two guys were doing that. You know, so I just think it's up to us to get to that information.
And to care enough to want to get that information. And to bring it outside of the investigative world, if you have an employee in your business, a manager, whoever, that has communication issues. Whether they're rude, whether they're disrespectful, whether they're discriminatory, whether they're abusive, whether they're harassing people. By the time it gets to your desk, brother, this ain't the first time. This is the first time that has progressed to a level or it happened in a situation or one person finally had enough and said, I'm going to put a stop to this. But it's not the first time. If you have somebody that is creating problems with customers or falling short with customers, by the time you hear about it, it's not the first time. So to your point, if we can look at it almost like in concentric rings of, okay, well, how long could this have been happening? Who else could this have been happening with? To your point, who set the example that made them feel like this was acceptable? Now, even if it's something that a leader can correct in a conversation or through a performance improvement plan, that somebody might not lose their job for this. but we can change the core operationally. We can change the course of the business with using this example to spearhead a new approach, a new conversation, a new whatever, in order to stop it completely or to change it to a better alternative completely. There was something else that I can probably tie into that somehow. We'll try this, where a lot of times in these conversations, we either get back what we put into the conversation, which you mentioned, and we don't realize it, or we feel like we heard what we wanted to hear. And so we stop asking questions. The curiosity goes away. The empathy goes away. We validate our expectations coming in. That feels great. Moving on. So I feel like that ties back to the comment you made about biases earlier, that often investigators or even managers, they don't realize. The funniest example for me is when I'm working with sales teams and they felt like they were getting the deal and then they don't. Well, what you don't realize is the customer or potential customer was just giving you what they knew you wanted to hear based on what you were saying so they could get out of this call and they could go on with the rest of the day. So you feel like this is going great. I'm going to get this business. They had zero intention at any point in that conversation of doing business with you. But it all ties back to biases. That's a very important piece that you mentioned earlier. So as we're kind of running on time here, I want to make sure we get back to that and take all the time you need. But from your experience in the room, training interviewers, coaching interviewers, what are some of the biases that you see people whose responsibility to get truthful information, the biases stop them from doing that?
Well, the one you just mentioned is a huge one, which is I assume that's how big the problem is. So now that I've gotten to that point, I'm done looking at it because it's gotten to the point where I think it would be, which doesn't mean that's what the reality of it is. So that I think that's a huge one. I think any of those, what we have to do, and I think this is a huge issue. I thought of it earlier when you said to me, when you made the statement about the person that asked you about, well, I don't want to manipulate in the interview room, and I feel this is manipulation. And, you know, those sorts of statements, I'm not making fun of the statement, but I hear those questions all the time in the interview room or in the training room. And I want to say to the person, do you really know yourself? And I think that we really have to do a lot of self-reflection. I mean, I come with a whole bag of flaws, man, but I need to know what my flaws are. And again, I think this has become easier for me. As I said, when those tires run over you enough, it becomes easier to do. I am what I am, and I come with a bag of weaknesses. I will discuss weaknesses in the interview room. I will, you know, I don't have a problem with any of that. But I think we have to know who we are. And I think an awful lot of those biases don't come about from the whole thing of knowing who we are. And I hear training on, you know, how to eliminate biases in your life. We're not going to eliminate biases. We need to know what they are. And we have them for all. I can't tell you, Michael, what yours are. I mean, I can label them, but I can't tell you the extent of them because I didn't live your life. You need to know what they are based on how you are lived. I mean, you obviously have some problems because you come from New England. So, you know, you got some issues there that you have to deal with.
The issue is that we typically beat the Steelers in the AFC Championship game for 20 years. Is that the biggest issue that I've got to overcome? You got us where you want us now for 20 years. Yeah, man.
But I think we have to know ourselves. We have to know those biases. We have to be aware of them so that when we feel them creeping in the interview room, we can put them away. I mean, we put a lot of stuff on the shelves in the interview room. When you think you've got all the information, you probably want to ask a couple more questions. And if you've developed that relationship in that interview room, you have earned the right to ask those questions, and you would be foolhardy not to ask them. So anytime you think you're banking up against one of those biases, you have to ask a couple more questions. You have to remain open to the fact that you might not know everything that's going on at this point.
Man, You just said a couple of super important things. The first one I'm going to jump on is earn the right to ask questions. Just because you're an investigator or you're a boss or you're a leader or you're a manager or you're a sales professional or you're in human resources or you're whatever, and your job is to get information, doesn't mean that you can just start gunning people down with questions. We have Amen. To earn the right to ask questions. We build rapport. We demonstrate credibility. We demonstrate empathy. We work our way through a conversation. We earn the right to ask questions. That is phenomenal. And I also love the concept of once we can become more aware of where our biases lie, we can ask more questions as we bump up against them. I think that is a brilliant concept. Because to your point, you're right. All of this, let me train you how to get rid of your biases, is BS. Our biases are hardwired into our brain. I saw one research study where they said there's 175 cognitive biases that human beings share just based on human evolution. Now, don't swear me to that number, but it sounds reasonable. Like I wouldn't argue with that. Right. Now, to your point, how right. those biases manifest in each individual based on their life and their experience and all those things is going to be different levels of intensity and focus and whatnot, of course. But if we just understand that that's part of how our brains work, there's no getting rid of them. There is just being aware that we have them, recognizing when they might be impacting or could have the ability to impact our judgment, our observations, our thoughts, our actions, and then showing more due diligence, showing more awareness, to your point, asking more questions as we get close to them to flush out. Is this what I'm really seeing, feeling, hearing, experiencing? Or is this what my mental shortcuts based on previous experience is telling me, or my expectations, even worse, is telling me what I'm experiencing? A concept that I was introduced to early in my investigations career, which I still share, is don't investigate to prove people guilty. Investigate to prove people innocent. Because right. if I investigate to prove something guilty, you can bet every dollar you have that at some point in the investigation, I will find something that indicates somebody's likely guilty, whether they are or not. But if I investigate right. to prove somebody innocent, now I have to exhaust more time, more option, more detail. I have to question what I'm doing. And if I set out to prove somebody innocent and I can't, well, then there's a higher likelihood that I've got the right person. But if I set out right. to investigate to prove that somebody's guilty, well, T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, I feel good. I did that, whether they're guilty or not. So those were some very, very powerful statements that you just made.
And I think on that issue of biases, Michael, they're so often couched as such a negative thing, but an awful lot of our biases come from our experiences. And our experiences actually equip us to interact with people and to make connection and to get to the center of the issue. So there's, you know, everything has a good and bad aspect to it, you know, depending on the way it's used. Some of those biases that come from experience become invaluable to us when we deal with somebody. If you've dealt with death in your life and you're dealing with somebody that's dealing with death, you have an ability to reach that person in a positive way. You don't put your framework, your glasses on that person, but you have a better way to ask them to understand where they're at. And you don't say stupid things like, well, I know what you're going through, which is such a useless term. You know, you say, tell me what you're feeling, and you get into that issue. So I think there's that positive side of what biases create in us, that we don't have to see that. I guess it's like manipulation, back to that word, you know, there's that upside and that downside. So I don't know, just my thought on that one.
No, that's a great thought. And I agree entirely. There's an argument potentially to be made, and I'm not the scientist, and I don't want to offend anybody, that a lot of the biases we have, quite honestly, are results of the evolution of the human brain, and that that's they've right. kept human beings alive and building relationships.
Alive.
And in many ways, they're right more often than they're wrong. But now, when you look at the world we live in today and how quickly it has changed, the world is changing faster than brains will evolve. So we have to right. be more aware, more in tune, more adaptable, more understanding, more empathetic. So biases that might have kept us alive 1,000 years ago now can create relationship problems can result in untruths, negative stereotypes, all these things that get in the way. So now those are all extremely valuable points that you just made. I can't thank you enough for this conversation and all that you shared today. There's no doubt that everybody listening to this is like, oh, I should think about it that way. Oh, I should do it that way. So for the people that have been listening and taking notes and want to connect more with you, to learn more from you, maybe participate in your training program, see some of the content that you put out, where should people go to learn more and connect with you?
They can go to my website, which I'm sure you'll have in the show notes or whatever, AndersonInvestigative.com. Connect with me on LinkedIn. I spend a lot of time on LinkedIn. I try to write articles or blogs every week on a subject. And I've kind of been moving out of that investigation arena a little bit because I see the connection between investigations. I see a lot the connection to leadership, but I also see a lot the connection to life itself. So I just had written a couple of blogs on dealing with adversity and building resilience coming out of that, which is definitely something we address in the interview room all the time, right? But it's also something we address every day in life. And most of the stuff I talk about, it's going to improve our performance in the interview room. It would improve our performance as leaders, but it also will improve our performance in life with those people that matter most to you. And if you're consistently applying this stuff across the board, you will be a better person, lead a happier life, and have a positive impact on those people around you. So I've been kind of heading into that arena. So the website, LinkedIn, either place you'll find my email, my phone number's on there. I'm not running a huge operation here, so I am happy to help you in any way I can with anything I have that would make a difference and improve the quality of your life.
Oh, you're right. Sorry. I will have all of it. No, stop saying sorry. I will have all of that in the show notes because I do want people to reach out and get a hold of you. And you are, once again, one more time, 100% right that everything we've talked about today and the content that you teach doesn't just make people better interviewers. It makes them more effective leaders. It makes them more effective communicators. It helps them in their family life, in conversations. There's so many of the techniques we're talking about I use with my son. I use in all aspects of my personal life. While I was in Chicago this week and the hotel charged me for something that I didn't think, I mean, it was their policy, so they had every right to do it, but I didn't think it was right. So I negotiated my way out of it, which again, they were happy to do. It's a customer service organization. I'm not saying it was the toughest negotiation ever, but by using a lot of the techniques that we talked about today, because if I just went down and said, this is BS, take it off my bill, their answer is going to be, well, Mr. Reddington, it's our policy. And then I'm out of bullets. But by using the things that we did today, they took it off the bill. So you're 100% right with everything you said. I can't thank you enough for being here today. You just gave us an hour worth of golden nuggets to apply to all of our conversations. Thank you so much. Please stay safe, take care, and I can't wait to see you at another event again soon. Mark, thank you for an awesome conversation. I really appreciate all of the insights you shared, your entire approach and philosophy to interviewing people and obtaining the truth. I took a bunch of great notes, and I hope everybody listening did as well. So many things we could recap. I love your thought of we have to earn the right to ask questions. Truer words have never been spoken. You're spot on. I also love how you talked about the importance of suspending judgment in all of our conversations. If we really want to connect with somebody and encourage them to share sensitive information, that's the key. The importance of planning ahead. We might not stick to the exact plan, but we got to have it. And I really appreciated the conversation of putting our biases on the shelf. We really can't educate them out, but we can educate the awareness that helps us put them on the shelf so we can do a better job obtaining the truth in all of our conversations. Thank you so much for sharing so many pearls of wisdom. And thank you to everybody again who took the time to be here and listen to another great conversation. As always, I hope you took as many notes as I did. Before we head out, let's thank our sponsors again real quick, HumanTel. If you want to develop the skill set necessary to understand what people are likely thinking or feeling at any moment in time, then please head over to HumanTel.com.
Read their research, check out their articles, then choose the training program that's right for you so you can begin to develop the skills necessary to recognize shifts in people's facial expressions and nonverbal communication that can help you pinpoint the emotions they're feeling at that point in time. I've done all the training. I highly recommend it. It's best in class. Enter the code INCUASIVE25 for 25% off of your training program that you select at humantel.com. For the professional interviewers, head over to certifiedinterviewer.com. That's where you can get all your questions answered about the International Association of Interviewers. What does it take to join at the individual or organizational level? How can you contribute to the organization? What training and educational programs are available online and in person? Tools and resources, networking opportunities, so much more. And while you're there, you can learn more about the Certified Forensic Interviewer designation as well. Who qualifies? What does it take to prepare and pass the exam? How do you maintain the designation? What could it mean for your career? And so much more at certifiedinterviewer.com. And while you're online, please check out inquasive.com. That's where you can learn more about the programs our clients ask us to custom facilitate for their senior leaders, business development professionals, their negotiators, and their HR team to teach them how to apply the skills, perspectives, and techniques necessary to encourage people to share sensitive information under vulnerable circumstances in the face of consequences in all of their high impact business and personal conversations. All that and more at inquasive.com. Thank you so much for being here week after week. We truly appreciate it. Before you go, please like the show, share the show, subscribe to the show, let your friends know about it, and give us feedback. What would you like to hear more of? What would you like to hear less of? We want to make sure we're giving you what you want and what helps you with your professional and personal conversations every day. Thank you all so much. Take care, stay safe, and we'll see you next time. Thank you.